This is a talk on the motivation and design aspects of OmniOS. One would expect, if you were ever to say, you know what, I'm going to build my own operating system distribution, the first question you should ask yourself are you fucking kidding me? Like, why would you do that? Like, that's kind of stupid. And I think that that's a really rational question to ask. And if you don't ask it of yourself in that tone of voice and have a really good rebuttal, you shouldn't do it. So I'm going to go through that. Real quick, I'm Theo Schlossnagel, founder of OmniTI. I'm an avid open source developer, Lumos contributor. I've contributed to about 100 different open source projects. I spend a lot of time making stuff work. At OmniTI, we build large-scale infrastructure for about 15% of the Alexa top 100. So the software that we run is the same software you all run. We run MySQL and Postgres and Apache and Nginx and PHP and Perl and Ruby and all of that kind of stuff. But our customers tend to push on those products in fascinating ways that take them to the point of breaking. And the reason that they hire us is because when they break, they don't want us to have to go to the community to solve the problem. They want us to solve the problem and go to the community with the solution to the problem. They don't want to have any sort of lockstep cycle with trying to troubleshoot something. They just want to say, fix my shit. So we log in and we fix our shit. So why did we build an OS? Kind of crazy. Fabulous movie. You have to ask yourself, what is your motivation, right? And if you don't have a respect for that, you don't have a respect for the craft. So kind of setting the stage for all of that, where is the world going, right? So the world is going into the cloud. I don't really like that very much, but I will concede that it's true. That is where we're going. We are going to the point where computing resources will be largely API-driven, largely homogenous. They will be a commodity like electricity. That may not happen in my lifetime, but it will happen. The most important thing to me, though, is that that is not what exists today. That's a vision today, but I don't make money and run businesses on vision. I make them and run them on execution. It's great to have vision to drive things forward, and we'll get there. But what does it look like? It looks like some intersection between something that's grounded and traditional and the cloud. And what we see is the two operating systems, and we're very biased to include Lumos in the first place, but Linux really sits there, right? Linux powers traditional data centers, and Linux powers the cloud. I think it's hard to say that Windows really powers the cloud. They do a pretty decent job with VMware and things like that, but if you look, all the VMware core-based products aren't really, the hypervisors aren't on Windows. But Linux actually makes a pretty decent hypervisor, and Lumos does as well. So those two kernels really sit, they bridge that gap. Like, you can build a traditional operating system off of Linux, and you can build a cloud platform architecture off of Linux using KVM or what have you, or Xen or what have you. And a lot of people have done that, right? You've got Amazon, who really is the show pony of everything. And then you've got VMware, you've got Joyent, you've got Eucalyptus, that are building technology platforms to enable people to use the cloud. And a lot of those things are based on either Linux or Lumos. And then you've got underneath that, you've got things like Ubuntu, you've got FreeBSD, you've got OmniOS, which are distributions that are really grounded in traditional data center legacy enterprise deployments, right? I got a box, I got bare metal, I'm gonna run an OS on it, I'm gonna run some apps on it, everything's gonna be good. So that's what the world looks like today. And I think that this, how many people here run systems that are more than 10 years old? There you go. So this is the way it is today, which means that 10 years from now, somebody's gonna be stuck with this shit anyway. So this will have at least a 10-year cycle, probably a 20-year cycle before the ground falls out from under us, at least. And I want to make that as pleasant as possible. And that's really my primary concern, is that I like the vision of the cloud. It is not executed well enough today to make me buy into it and be happy. But once it delivers on its promises, I think that it really will be a great platform for pretty much universal deployment. But today, it's not there, and I don't want to be miserable while I'm living in today's reality. So, some brief history. We ran a lot of Linux. It's not on the slide, but we run a lot of Linux for our clients. I mean, we service very, very large customers. And how many people here run Linux? Yeah, there you go. Yes, just like our customers. Everybody runs Linux. We have Linux running places. We also ran a lot of Solaris, starting back in Sonos 4, and then Solaris 5, 2.5, 2.6, Solaris 7, Solaris 8, Solaris 9. And it was always that crufty enterprise OS with commercial support that was well engineered. The support was fantastic from Sun. You could run some enterprise products on it, like Oracle. That was pretty much what we used it for. And then Solaris 10 came along and started to change that playing field a lot with the technologies that it brought to the front. So it's particularly ZFS. So when ZFS was introduced in Solaris 10, our engineers who ran on it were, logging into their Oracle box and running stuff, and then they realized that they could throw Veritas Volume Manager out the window because they had ZFS snapshots. And they could go, oh my God, I can run this on every box I have. I can have ZFS, I can have ZFS snapshots, I can have block level incremental send and receives across my network. This is fucking fantastic. I can do this. All I need to do is port my apps to Solaris. Most of them ran PHP apps, which meant that they had to run them, and that was it, because PHP runs there. So what we learned in running a lot of Solaris 10 and all the way up from the Solaris 10 GA all the way through U9 and Solaris Express Community Edition, SXCE, what I learned is that I really liked Dtrace and Crossbow. So Dtrace is an instrumentation framework for the system in general. It allows instrumentation of a kernel, user space, applications. You can always go down all the way into the hardware drivers. It's pretty fantastic. Crossbow is network virtualization, the idea of being able to virtualize TCP stacks, virtualize routing tables, virtualize networks and switches within the system, so you can actually build up an entire network topology with VMs running connected to each other over private virtual switches with quality of service controls across them. It's kind of crazy. FreeBSD could do this, some of this stuff with some of the drivers. They had the NetGraph drivers and things like that. But Solaris brought that and made it accessible in production. So I liked those things. I also learned that I love ABI stability. This was the reason that I kind of have a shit fit whenever we have to do upgrades on Linux boxes, is because I can't just move my apps over and run them. Because it's like, oh, libc is different or something like that. Right? It's kind of crazy. ABI stability means that I compile something into an object format, and that object, or an ELF executable, and I can run that ELF executable on the next version of the OS. That's basically there. The ABIs, the application binary interfaces, they talk to each other through the libraries and things like that. They just don't change, which means that I can take products that were built for Solaris 2.6 a very, very long time ago, that's more than 10 years ago, probably 15 years ago, and run them today on a Solaris 10 box, and they work. Which is crazy if you run Linux, because you're like, that's not possible. And it's like, well, yes, it is. One of the claims a long time ago in Linux, the reason that they didn't want ABI stability, it's not that they didn't want it, is they didn't want to pay the cost for ABI stability. They wanted to let the ABI kind of flow, because stabilizing the ABI would limit innovation. Like, you could only get things like ZFS and Dtrace, apparently. Right, so to me, it didn't limit the innovation at all. It was an excuse and it didn't work. Also really love zones. So zones are akin to FreeBSD jails and Linux containers, basically. So we use those in our data center. We use Crossbow and zones extensively in our data center to do isolation of clients in our managed hosting platform. But I also learned two things that I needed. They were actually fundamental needs that we had. One of them was ZFS. The amount of business-ending events that have been averted on our customers and internally that have been averted by ZFS, I cannot count on one hand anymore, which is pretty crazy. Never lost data on ZFS. I've lost data on every other file system I've ever used, including my second love, which is Veritas File System. And I also realized that I absolutely need open source. There were open tickets in Solaris 10, that we opened a ticket with Sun, and it got scheduled, and they only had like 200 kernel engineers, so not enough to prioritize everybody's problems, but they couldn't get fixed, and it was very frustrating to me. And then when they opened Solaris, I realized oh my God, I can fix this stuff myself, right? So I went in, fixed some drivers, fixed some things like that, and found that I could fix the code, but it was really hard to produce a working system out of that. Like, building it was hard. And if anybody's used FreeBSD, like, you can type, you go into user source, you type make world. And what happens? It makes a world, and it's done, and it works. And it's like, holy shit, this is what building an operating system should be like. It should be one command, and it should work every time. Linux, a little bit harder, because you can build the kernel, but Linux is really only a kernel. It's not the distribution. You've got the distribution aspects to it. But Sun open-sourced Solaris, the future of Solaris 10 as Solaris 11, and the future was very bright, and we were very excited, and we started to invest in our company, invest in ways that that banked on that promise from Sun. And I won't say Sun wasn't good on its promise, but there was a Solaris eclipse that happened, internal memo that's probably worth reading, where Oracle decided to abandon the openness of the project that Sun had opened, and apparently there was much gangsta pouring of 40s for the death of Sun. You know, some people take this stuff very, very seriously, and we were left in a very awkward situation where we had a data center or two or three that were entirely built around Zones, Crossbow, and ZFS. And we immediately said, well, this is bad news. We've dealt with Oracle via our customers on a legal side before, and kind of, you know, I don't ever want to be beholden. Happy to use Oracle products. I think some of their products are fantastic. Never want to be beholden to a vendor, specifically Oracle. So always want to have my options open, even if I choose that one. So the question was, if we want to switch off, what do we switch to? And we looked at Linux, and we looked at FreeBSD, and we looked at Open Indiana, which we had some issues. We looked all around, and we didn't really find anything that we liked. FreeBSD was the best bet, but made everybody kind of ill. Just it was very hard to find talent for it. So we have a lot of traditional deployments where we are. We have a lot of stuff that runs on bare metal. We are not, you know, the idea behind, not the cloud so much, but virtualization is that I've got all of these servers in my data center, and I've got a super powerful server tomorrow, right? I can buy a super powerful, you know, 128 core box tomorrow, and I can jam all 100 servers onto one using virtualization. So our clients have a very different mentality about that. It's like, I can buy 128 core box tomorrow, that's awesome. I can take my 10,000 servers and only deploy 2,000, right? It's not that I can take 100 servers and consolidate them onto one, because each instance is actually saturating the entire box. It's very rare where we have production services where they can be co-located on the same box. So we really want to be able to deploy our stuff seamlessly across this idea of dense virtualization and single virtualization, like the idea of running a piece of bare metal with an application on it and not paying a large cost for a virtualization layer between those. So zones and Linux containers and FreeBSD GLs actually give you that good abstraction, right? You can virtualize stuff, it's a lightweight virtualization. So we needed that. And the cloud wasn't really a great idea for us, the KVM stuff. The performance overhead was too high. So if Solaris 11 had been opened, we probably would have been disappointed at the change of control and the change of, you know, all the changes that would happen. But you know what? We still got what we need. We got it open source. We got ZFS. We got zones. We got Crossbow. Everything would have been happy. But the fact that we couldn't see the source meant that we were handicapped. And our clients expect us to be able to fix problems when they break, unconditionally, fix them in basically anything. So we have patches in MySQL and Postgres and pretty much every product we touch because shit breaks and we fix it. And it was important that we be able to do that. So what we really wanted to do is have a path of least resistance from all of our Solaris 10 deployments onto to this new thing. And it turns out that we really wanted to deliver on the promise that Sun made of this open, buildable, you know, Solaris 11. We couldn't call it Solaris, but the awesome part of this, of course, the question, right? It's not, why would you build an operating system? It's like, why the fuck would you do that, right? So there's a little bit more of a justification, and there happens to be a business model, right? So we have positive return on investment inside today. So we launched OmniOS formally in April. It was like the first week of April. And we are cash flow positive on OmniOS today. From income revenue generated by OmniOS support and revenue cost saved not going to Oracle. So what were the goals? How did we define the project? Goal one was the things that we like, love, and need, right? It was, I wanted ABI stability, I wanted ZFS, zones, Crossbow, dtrace, and I needed to be open source. And Illumos provided that. And there was this magical extra incentive that came along with that, in that Joyent did the fabulous work to port KVM onto Illumos, so we also had hardware-based virtualization as well, and it's first class. So that was fabulous. We got all of that, which reconfirmed our initial bias that we wanted to use Illumos because it was least disruptive. The other thing is that we needed it to be traditionally installable. And if anybody's ever done any operating system work, getting your kernel work and getting your user space to work is actually pretty easy compared to getting to fucking install, right? Like actually getting a disk to boot and to run an installer, because you don't have that stuff running on an installed anything at this point. Identifying your disks when it doesn't work, the hardware doesn't work, there's no debugging environment, it's really obnoxious. So we wanted to deal with that. And I hate doing I hate doing traditional installs, right? Nobody installs things off of CDs and USB keys anymore, right? If I'm gonna install 1,000 servers, it's not like I'm gonna send an army of engineers with 1,000 USB sticks in, right? You netboot. So we wanted to do netbooting for this. So we ended up building a project called Kayak, which actually uses ZFS-based disk imaging. So what it does is we can take an OmniOS install and we create an alternate root ZFS file system. We do a full operating system install onto that ZFS file system, and then we block level send it to a file. And then we can ship that file to boxes and they just get flashed right onto the Zpool. So the install process for that is a really thin shim that Pixie boots and identifies the disks, creates a Zpool, and then curls a ZFS-based disk image and blasts it onto disk. And the really cool part about this is that we're not the only operating system that runs ZFS. So if you run FreeBSD in your data center, this is probably a really slick project to check out, because I think it would probably take one or two lines of code change to make it work. It uses ZFS, which FreeBSD has in spades. The other problem that we had was that traditional operating systems have pretty dated base software. I mean, it's one of the biggest frustrations we have with running things like Ubuntu and Red Hat and all of that stuff. And it's not just them, it's pretty much every OS. I go and install my OS, and 6 months later, every single piece of software is out of date. All the versions are out of date. My developers want something newer. We ran into this problem. We run into this problem all the time because our clients run Linux, a lot of them. And you know, the Ruby developer comes in and it's like, well, I need, you know, this version of Graphics Magic or something like that. And it's like, well, the system ships an older one. Like, crap, we have to roll our own, right? So we have a suite of libraries we roll for our clients pretty much at every version. So we end up rolling all of our own packages for our clients that run on Red Hat, because they need specific versions and they don't want to be locked into the vendor shipped version for that. They want to be somewhat independent of that. So ideally, the core operating system doesn't depend on any of that. Sadly, Illumos does need three absolutely critical and universal libraries, which is unfortunate. They need OpenSSL, they need libxml, and they need zlib. A whole bunch of internal tools to the system that really rely on those. And the versions were butt old, like really old. Zlib specifically. Libxml was quite out of date, like 7-8 years out of date. And OpenSSL was 0.97. And when we were developing OmniOS first release, 101 was available. So we upgraded all of that stuff to the tip of tree. We've shifted everything over to GCC. We're actually running, the newer releases are running 4.7.2. So it was shifting all the stuff that was absolutely critical to the OS to the latest version to be the least impediment. But we have a very strong philosophy at OmniTI of keep your shit to yourself. So when we develop and deploy on a specific platform, the goal is to not use really any of the OS shipped libraries or binaries, right? If I need something, I'm gonna roll it all myself and ship it. We'll RPM it or debit or whatever. The beauty of that is if I decide to switch from CentOS 5 to CentOS 6 or to Ubuntu, like I just reroll my packages, right? I don't really care so much about what's running on the OS. So we upgraded that. The fourth thing that we wanted to do, which was a very frustrating part of the Open Solaris initiative, is that the instruction set for building Open Solaris was like 23 complicated steps, and then maybe you had something that worked at the end. It was a very, very difficult thing to navigate for someone newly entering the Open Solaris development world. So we wanted to make sure that the operating system that we shipped could build every bit that we shipped. We have some closed bits due to some Open Solaris legacy, but everything that gets built that we shipped is buildable. We do ship some distributable binary bits in there, some old drivers that didn't get released and stuff. So this is my subjective take on a thick, just enough operating system. So this is just enough operating system to be self-sustaining and self-buildable. So you can download OmniOS, and the package repository that's referenced in that build has every single package you need, all the GCCs, all the supporting libraries, all the autoconf, all that crap, to build all of the packages that you can download. That ends up being 111 pieces of software. Some of those actually extrapolate into multiple packages, but it ends up being a lot of packages. But there's 111 pieces of software if you think of like the kernel as a piece of software and you think of like GCC as a piece of software. That's easy. Put that shit in a box and ship it, right? 111 pieces of software is tiny for an operating system distribution. One of the other things that we really liked about Solaris was the multiple instruction set support. So you can have 32-bit and 64-bit support on the same box. And unfortunately, you can do that on Linux as well. Unfortunately, different distributions decide to take completely different tact on how to deliver that. And I thought the way that Solaris approached that problem was incredibly sane. So we maintained that. And we ship both 32-bit and 64-bit libs fairly consistently for everything in the operating system. So that if you want to build something 64-bit, all of your libs are there and in 64-bit. If you want to build something 32-bit, there's apps out there that really won't build and function correctly as 64-bit apps. So you can build them as 32-bit. And they all run on the same box. And then to establish a rigorous major release cycle that actually made sense. So we deal with a lot of risk and compliance issues. Our customers need PCI DSS compliance, HIPAA compliance, SOX compliance, all those things. And all of those end up in critical, like where personal information is involved or credit card information is involved, finance, things like that. You have to have your boxes patched within usually 30 days. Like you cannot have a box that's out more than 30 days out of date. And it was a pain in the butt with all the other distributions to keep that up to date. So we took sort of an OpenBSD cycle on this in that we would do a release every 6 months. So we did our first release, which was named 151.002 in April, and our most recent release was 151.04. It was done in October. So we're on schedule for all of that stuff. That was great. Every 6 months, it's a somewhat disruptive change. Pretty much everything in the system is going to change. None of the ABIs will. All your apps will still run. It's great. So I can change the kernel. I'm going to upgrade the kernel. I'm going to upgrade all the patch fixes go in and things like that. Of course, that isn't perfect for security releases, right? So for security releases, what we do is we have a weekly release cycle A through Z. And conveniently, the English alphabet and the 52-week calendar align perfectly for this. So we have A through Z once, and then A through Z again in the year. So those come out every week. And sometimes they just don't come out. If there are no critical security issues or denial of service attack issues, then that week is just skipped. So the most common updates in here are PCI IDs, things like that, that get updated for recognizing new devices that get shipped by vendors and things like that. In the 151.002 release cycle, for example, there were two updates that required reboot. I forget what the first one was. The second one was the SIGRET exploit, the Intel 64-bit exploit, which was horrific. And we were able to deliver that inside the week. So once we recognized it, it fit into the next ship date, which was great. So we had about 3 days of exposure on that from when code was available to fix it. And then we needed to provide commercial support. So all of our customers basically require customer, like commercial support in a contractual form where they can actually hold someone legally responsible for not supporting them. ShamWow guy. It's the best image for that, right? I'll give you it in a bag. So getting into some of the details. So what is this Kayak thing? Kayak's an open source project. It kind of embodies what you would think as a systems administrator an install tool should look like. Like, it's written in shell, right? Everybody knows shell. It's written in bash. Everything's good. There's a tiny little Python web server that knows how to like receive logs. So like if you have an install fail, it'll ship the logs of the failure back up. There's a little tiny Python web server that does that. We happen to ship Python in the operating system because of our packaging system, which I'll get into in a bit. So what it does is it builds an alt root install. So it creates a file system and then it does a fresh full package install. If anybody's used Mocker for building things on Linux, very similar to that. It like creates a new directory and it does a full operating system install in that directory. ZFS receives it into a file, and then when you pixie boot, you can pass specific arguments in the pixie boot and it'll fetch the right image and it looks it up by MAC address, and it's what you would expect the most simple possible installer to look like. And we go from bare metal to fully booted system in about 2 minutes. That's through the entire first boot, install, and then reboot into a working system. It's about 2 minutes to get that from bare metal to running, which is really great because if you're actually doing a lot of complex software, we package all sorts of stuff, not inside of OmniOS, but we package like a RabbitMQ servers, Postgres servers, and all sorts of stuff like that. And we can just create images of what we want that box to look like. So I specify a package list of what I want on a box, and boom, like 45 minutes later, I get a ZFS image of exactly what that box looks like. And I can get any box in my data center from bare metal to that image running all of that software in 2 minutes. And that's great. That works for me. So it's all written in shell, so everyone here can use it, which is great. So what does the release cycle actually look like? I have a little diagram. I think I explained it pretty well. So we have 151.02a. We usually are so uncoordinated when we release, we don't call them A. They're just B. We start calling them B. So A gets forked into 151.03, which is our development for the next version. So 151.03 is our unstable, what we call our bloody release. And immediately, irregular spasmodic changes happen on that. This is where we're pulling all of our upstream stuff in. We're pulling in stuff from Joyent. We're pulling in stuff from Delphix. We're you know, making our own changes. We're changing the build system. We're upgrading GCC. We're doing all this stuff. It's incredibly hectic. Basically, anytime you do a package update on this, it's going to cause you to reboot because we got a new kernel build every 2 days in this system. You would not run this in production. We usually have a canary box sitting in almost every production network we have that does run this, that we can reboot, but it's really there to weed out production issues. So 151.02, when we do the releases there, we selectively backport only things that are absolutely critical for security reasons and for like regressions. And then those release, we get a C, we get a D, and then those end up being 1 week apart. So we have a regular release schedule, 7 days after the initial release, all the way 26 weeks out. And then that goes all the way up to Z. And right around the same time that Z is coming out, there is a code freeze in this bloody tree. And these two things become 151.004A, which then repeats right down to the next release, which is actually, right or wrong, it's actually been incredibly pleasant to have a process documented that everyone who runs this can trust. So when someone's running bloody, they know what time of year it is, they know when the release was, they know when the next one's coming, they can do all of their planning. I don't need to actually ask any questions, like, is this going to be on time? Well, I don't have any more letters than Z, so yes, it's going to be on time. What the hell am I going to do, right? So I'm going to flip to A, and that's what's going to happen. So this has been incredibly useful for us, mainly in our planning. Knowing that we have a six-month cycle means that we're very, very cognizant of what features we're merging in and which ones we're testing and things like that into the bloody branches, which is great. It's also available on EC2, so you can just boot an AMI in any availability zone in any region of OmniOS, the most recent release. So we have some holy wars. Everyone has holy wars, right? So editor holy war, VI1, naturally. We don't ship Emacs. Sorry, Leif. So fine. I don't think any self-respecting sysadmin is going to argue that you shouldn't ship VI on your box, hopefully. We can have a fisticuff afterwards.
Which VI?
Which VI?
Is it Vim
VI,
or are you shipping that Vim thing?
We are shipping Vim. The reason we're shipping Vim is because if we shipped regular VI, we'd have to ship Vim too, as well, and we just didn't want to build it twice. So we shipped Vim. We also shipped Bash. I mean, we're lazy. We have some convenient stuff in there. I would say that it, when I say just enough OS, there are absolutely personal biases in there. All right, like screen. Or TMUX, we ship TMUX, not screen, are not required. They're just going in, right? They're going to be there, even though it's not absolutely required to boot and run the box. Like, I don't want to live in a world without TMUX. Like, that's just not right. So there are certain things that went into the operating system, but we tried to keep them minimal. For example, TCP dump. It did go in. Snoop ships with it, and Snoop can do pretty much everything TCP dump does, but there is so much online documentation and scripts that understand TCP dump and how to use it that it's just too much work to, everyone's gonna end up installing TCP dump, so we just included it in the core. ZFS, obviously, file system, that one won. And this one is the whole what the fuck, like really, IPS? Like why would you choose IPS? What's that? You're here with it. All right. Well, you'd be the in the minority. So I have a much more cynical view of why we chose IPS, and it's because they all fucking suck. Like every packaging system sucks, right? RPM we use all the time. We use Debian format. We use SVR4 packages, which actually they suck. Yeah, but they're not that bad, right? It's basically a glorified tarball with some post-install and pre-install scripts. Like I can work with that. I'm a sysadmin, right? Like IPS is actually a little more frustrating in that it doesn't have pre-install scripts or post-install scripts, so I can just install files. It's kind of tricky to work around. One of the huge problems with IPS is that they proposed all these awesome solutions to problems that we didn't have. And in doing that, they brought those new fantastic problems into the system because you can't really ship a solution without a problem. So they had to create the problem first. That was a problem. IPS is uncommon. There's not much knowledge around it. So what was the justification for using IPS? Again, it was the path of least resistance. So Illumos, the Illumos gate actually natively builds an entire IPS repository of all of its bits. It's like 843 packages, I think, of all of the bits, all of the drivers, all of the kernel, all the user land, all of the different pieces are all split out sanely, arguably, into these massive array of IPS packages. And the entire build environment is instrumented around IPS, and it works. And IPackage zones are a core feature in Solaris. So we didn't really want to screw with that. We didn't want to have to develop our own. And when I thought about it, there's another project that's trying to do this with Debian package format, I believe. And they really want to move to it, and my short answer to that is, like, that's a neat project. Sounds like a lot of work. Wow, what do I get for that at the end? And it's like, you get Deb. Like, who the fuck cares? Like, I don't, at the end, after my package is installed, I actually don't care what packaging system I'm running. Right, so, like, if really the only benefit I get from switching is that I got to use a different format, it's like moving all of your movie file, or like all of your music files from WAV to MP3 and not getting compression, right? Like, I just want to listen to the music. Like, don't change the format. There's no good reason. There's no compelling outcome. There's no return on that investment. And I really hate packaging. This was a quote from me. It's packaging other people's software that makes systems administrators violent people. I truly believe this. If anybody has done, how many people have packaged software? Yes. How many people have taken a break from that for over like a week or two at any point, right? Reflect on the quality of your life. At the end of that 2 weeks, It's unbelievable. Like, I can get agitated and angry. I don't have blood pressure problems, but I feel some sense of anxiety. I'm trying to control, homicidal ideas. Like, people, one, don't know how to write software. They also don't know how to write software that builds, and they certainly don't know how to write software that installs. All of which you have to do to package it, right? So it should piss you off, pisses me off. And it turns out that if you avoid all of the solutions that IPS brings, you actually don't carry the problems for it either. I'm looking at you, facets. So there's this concept of facets, which is brain damaged in IPS. And you can read it and you can look at it and you can say, that could be a good idea. But when you start to consider all of the baggage that it brings with it and all the problems that it creates, it's not worth it. And then I also have an idea of these things called incorporations, which are used all over the place in Solaris 11 and in Open Indiana. And they cause a nightmare. So we have a very minimal use and clever use. We looked at what they did. Incorporations allow you to lock things into specific versions. Like, you can't upgrade them. You can't downgrade them. So you end up locking them into specific versions. And what it's used for in traditionally in the Open Solaris world is to lock the distribution, so you don't upgrade from version 5 to version 6 sort of thing. So like the CentOS 5 to CentOS 6, you'd lock at 5. So you can upgrade within that, but it wouldn't let you upgrade past that. If I put a new package in, I want to upgrade to it, right? Or I wouldn't put it in. It's pretty simple. We had some clever uses of incorporations. So the things that I really like about IPS is that it's a network resource. It's a first-class network resource. It's over HTTP. You can use an HTTP caching accelerator anywhere in your network to make it really, really fast. So if you feel like your RPM, remote RPM, you don't have to mirror the repository. You can really just turn on an HTTP cache, and it just works. It's pretty fantastic. Package send is a tool, not a framework. So all of the individual tools, you know how RPM, you have a spec file and it has this RPM build process that runs through the whole thing. Well, the package tools are really like underneath the hood there. It gives you like all of these different tools and you write a shell script that uses them. So you open the package and then you start sending files into the package and you send some metadata in and then you close the package. But because it gives you all the individual tooling, you're not roped into using that like RPM build style world. You can build your own build framework. And we built our own build framework using the old build framework we had. We just kind of copied it over, hacked it up, and boom, it produced IPS. It was really convenient. And perhaps most importantly, IPS supports all of the alternate boot environment magic that ZFS provides in Solaris. So when I do an upgrade in Solaris and I flip my kernel out, this is the stuff that like fucking freaks me about Linux, right? So I'm like in there and I'm gonna do an upgrade and I do an RPM upgrade or yum update or whatever it is. And it's like updating kernel. And I'm like, shoo, I wonder what happens when that doesn't boot? Which is kind of interesting. And it's like it's got an old kernel. And then it has upgrading libc. And we all know, or at least if you haven't been punished as severely as I, you might not. But when you upgrade libc, it's very likely, can be likely, that it may not boot in the old kernel. They're very fragile. Like all that shit's just really fragile. So it's possible that your system won't boot and you have no copy of the old system because it upgraded in place. So because ZFS is the root file system in all the Solaris-based distros now, what it does is it snapshots the old file system and clones it and creates a new boot environment, upgrades that one, and reboots into it. So you have two completely accurate boot environments. You have your old one that has not been upgraded, that is completely the old bit you were running, everything, all the drivers, all the kernel, all the user space, everything, and you've got the new one. So when it doesn't work, you boot the old one, and it's much less risk. And without all the little features, it tends to just work. So we built a tremendous number of packages for Solaris 10 and Linux and FreeBSD because everyone's a snowflake, right? And we actually found out that's true. I mean, we have probably 60 versions of Postgres Server floating around as builds in our environment, because we have everyone's running slightly different version. There's certain bugs that they don't want to upgrade to. They're not ready for their upgrades. Some of them use float date. Some of them use different compile options. All sorts of shit, right? And that's real. Those are real requirements. Those are interesting things. And if CentOS doesn't give them to me or Ubuntu doesn't give them to me, tough shit. I still have to do them, right? So I end up rolling that, and then I end up rolling everything else. So we have hundreds and hundreds of packages we end up rolling. So the idea of rolling 111 for the OS was not at all intimidating. In fact, about 80 of them we had already been rolling. So we just switched their prefix to slash user and we were kind of done, which is great. So it really only ships a core. We don't ship a web server. We don't ship a database. We don't ship a proxy cache. There's no PHP. Unfortunately, we do ship Perl and Python. Perl is required to build a whole bunch of stuff, and there's some system tools written in Perl that need to die that are there. The packaging system uses Python. We've been tempted to reinstall Python and not slash user, but in slash stay the fuck out. But the goal is that, like, that's the systems. Keep your shit to yourself, right? If you're going to run an app, don't rely on that. And what that means is that when we do an upgrade and we change the Perl version or change the Python version, this will always piss people off because they're going to use that. But we don't have to worry about changing the Ruby version or the web server version or, like, I don't want to run that operating system because HTTPD is too old or they don't have Nginx. And it's like those arguments are all gone because, like, that's not our problem, right? Our operating system is much more base than that. And what that allows you to do is to really treat it like a layered cake. And this is what we do. So we have OmniOS as the core underneath what we run in our managed services environment. And then our managed MS is for managed services. So our managed services group has a shit ton of packages. And there's like 600 or 700 different packages, like graphics magic and GraphViz and like accounting packages, all sorts of, like, all the crap that somebody would like, I want this. And it's like, what are you gonna say, no? So you build the software, you package it, you ship it. But the beauty is all of that stuff is very, very self-contained, and you can mix and match these different repositories, and the system kind of just works. It's kind of like the yum repos D type thing, except it's a little bit more sane because our systems end up being more highly segregated than that. And then because all of this stuff is namespaced out, we're actually able to delegate to our engineering group the whole management of the Perl domain. And we have about 1,000 packages in the Perl. All the CPAN modules end up getting built and packaged into IPS. They cannibalized our build system and made it Perly, and then they shot in all of that. And the beauty of that, and this is where we actually use incorporations, is that we have Perl 5.10, we have 5.14, we have 5.16. And they're all named differently. But all of the modules that we release are like DBD MySQL, for example, the database driver for MySQL for Perl. It's called DBD MySQL. And there are three different versions of that that are all named identically, but are locked into the actual master Perl of version, that, the master version of Perl that they use via incorporations. So we lock all of the modules to be able to reuse the namespaces with incorporations. That way, once you install Perl, it's just called Perl. And if you just package install Perl, it's kind of freaky. It like doesn't work very well. You get the latest version of everything. It's kind of weird. And if you did an upgrade, it would go to like 5.18 when it's available. But if you install Perl 5.16.2 incorporation, then you can install all the Perl packages with the same names, and they'll all be locked into that version, which is really nice. So I like to think of OmniOS more than a production operating system as a distribution construction kit, because it's really only what's needed to boot, aside from like VI and tmux and TCP dump and a couple of other tiny like subjective decisions that were made, you can't get away with anything less. So if you want to build something on top of a Lumos, this is self-building. The build system allows for like our entire managed services repo that builds all of our private packages, which are actually, they're public, right? You can use our managed services repo. All of the build system for that is on GitHub. You can just clone it and add your own packages in, like just build your own packages, run your own IPS repo. So it makes the idea of delegating all of the individual, like the stack that you run ends up being very proprietary. Even though it has MySQL and it has Apache and it has all these other things in it, it's specific versions with specific compile options that are yours. And those are important, right? That's how you've QA'd your app. It's how you've QA'd everything that you do. People expect exactly those versions and those compile options. So the idea of managing your own build environment for that is incredibly low work now because of this system. So I think that's it. How much time do I have left?
You can go as long as you want.
Oh.
45 minutes left if you want.
No, I don't want to do that. I want to ask questions. I want people to ask questions. So Thanks. You can get it if you go to omniosomniti.com. You can get it as a Vagrant box, so it'll just boot right up if you're running Vagrant anywhere. You can get it as an ISO or USB, and you can boot it anywhere in AMI. So if you use Amazon, it's probably the path of least resistance to actually using Dtrace to see how fucking crazy slow Amazon is. It's pretty awesome. Anybody have any questions? Anybody here use Solaris? Oh, there you go. Anybody use Solaris? Not, yeah. There is hope. There is a path.
Did I hear you say you're going to maintain binary compatibility with 11 also? Excuse me. Did you use the microphone?
The question was, did I say I would maintain binary compatibility with 11? That is a promise I cannot make because 11 is not. So ABI compatibility only goes backwards, and because Illumos forked off before Solaris 11 was released, there have been changes in Solaris 11 that do not exist in Illumos, and vice versa. But as of we can guarantee ABI compatibility in 10 and back. 10 update 8, I believe. I'd have to check that. I think update 9 came out after the snuff film was produced. No questions? Oh, come on.
Is NFS part of the picture from your point of view?
Is NFS part of the picture?
For what you're supporting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, NFS is core to the operating system, so we support NFS. And CIFS as well.
So since you support multiple versions of the same thing, and your mantra is don't touch other people's shit, do you install them each in their own paths, or are you limited to one version per zone system-like object?
So, I mean, the core OS, we really only support the latest versions, right? Like, any self-respecting vendor will lie to you and say that they support all the versions, and then when you have a bug, they say upgrade to the latest version, right?
I meant your package repository, like Perl 5, 12, 14, 16, right?
They do not. So the Perl packages, you can only install one in any, they install in the same path. So you can install different ones in different zones, but you can't install Perl 5, 14, and 5, 16. That was a conscious decision by committee of the guys doing the management of the Perl repository. On the contrary, the Postgres guys, by decision, decided that all of the Postgres stuff needed to be co-installed, because when you do the upgrade processes in Postgres, you want both the binaries around. So they chose a different tack for that, so you can dual install those. So it's really up to the maintainers of the packages.
So case by case basis.
Yeah. Okay. I think something about Perl being so brain damaged already that if you had two versions, you would implode or something like that. I don't remember what it was. It seemed like a good justification. I coded in Perl for a very long time. I have a love-abuse relationship with it. That's it. Who's going to go try OmniOS? Right.
Toby Attiker, Switzerland. I recently installed SmartOS. So I have already these pools on my machine. They're all RAID set 2. Can I then, what happens when I run your installer?
If, you should be careful. You should run the text installer. So the network installer is pretty violent. It will destroy, if you point it at a disk, it assumes you know what you're doing. The network installer assumes that you know exactly what you're doing.
It will not see that there is already a pool.
Oh, of course. But every box that I want to re-image also already has a pool. So that's why we do that. The text installer, much like it shows you the disks and you choose the ones you want. So use the ISO or the USB. But as long as you've got a disk, you need a disk to install to. It's an installed on disk product.
You can't install into an existing pool.
I don't know.
I think nice.
SmartOS would be tricky. SmartOS has taken liberties with the traditional OI model for how it's booted. You could probably do the alternate boot install from a booted SmartOS box. So if you take the ZFS image from Kayak and actually just pull it in and put it as a root, and then fudge the ZFS root boot flags on it, you should probably be able to boot cross boot into it.
So you can boot RAID Z2.
But can we boot RAID Z2? Someone added that into Grub. I thought it was in. I don't know. Is Brendan here? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to check if we can boot RAID Z2.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you know if you can do that with OI? You don't know. All right, I'll have to check. You can. I know you can do it with FreeBSD. The question is whether Illumos Gate took those patches back yet. I'm not sure. That's it. I have some t-shirts.